From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always good to have old friends on the show, especially old friends who've never done the show before. And my relationship with Alan Hughes goes back to Sundance in 1999. Our first conversation was about music, so it makes sense that he would be the director, producer, and the man behind one of the biggest documentaries of the year, the HBO series Defiant Ones on Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I didn't know I had never been here before.
Yeah, we talked so many times, and it just seems like it would be natural for you to be here. And but one of the things I said to you before, which this fits into, that we go back to your first film, to Menace to Society, to I think even your first film on your own, A Broken City, so much what you do is about the way men use power.
Hmm.
And I've always wondered where that came from for you.
It's so interesting because you said that at a screening, and I was like, wow, I never knew that. You know, I really didn't. You know, so one time I was talking with Robbie Coltrane, the great Scottish actor, and he was watching some of From Hell before it came on. He goes, "Are you Catholic?" And I said, "Why?" He goes, "You're very ritualistic. Everything's very ritualistic." I go, "I wasn't aware of that." So, you know, I think a lot of this stuff is obvious. You know, when you're doing your thing, you're not aware of maybe some of those themes that are common in your work. And so it wasn't until you said that. So I don't even know how to speak to that, you know, to tell you the truth.
But it's interesting, too, because in this, we're watching two guys, Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, rise to power, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also interesting, too, because I said this to you, we did the Q&A after the screening, that this is as personal, probably the most personal thing you've ever done, and it must have surprised you.
100%, yeah. It absolutely is the most personal thing I've ever been involved in film-wise, and I didn't know that until, like, it's been a 3.5-year physical process until about a year and a half ago. I was like, wow, this is deep. And it does have a lot to do with power and rising to power. And I've known both those gentlemen for over 25 years. And I didn't see that until I was in it. Like, you know, like the ambition. I mean, I'm talking about like it's sometimes reckless ambition, you know, to get to the top. You know, I didn't see the similarities there between Iovine and Dre until I was in it. Because I know them as, just like me and you know each other off air, it's a different dynamic than, you know, what your on-air personality may be or what your...
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. So you don't know these things until you start working with people. And I was like, wow, you know, how the focus and the drive of the two of those men is just, it's off the charts. When you talk about power, there's a lot of power in different senses of that word as well. And drive to get to the top, you know?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, you know? that why of it is so interesting, too, because it's also, you said reckless power. So much of the film over the 4 hours is about the power of pop culture, too,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of unchecked power, especially when you're in the middle of it, as these guys were, and not seeing the effects of it.
Straight up. Yeah. When you're in the middle of it, and I refer to part three, I've referred to it as Apocalypse Now, because it does become, especially in the 90s, how the culture of music was changing. And by that I mean, let's just table the rock for a second. Let's just talk about hip hop. Like they were literally gangsters now in the suits, in the suites, I'm sorry, and the studios. Like, you know, art imitating life and life imitating art, it had blurred so deeply, you know, culminating in the deaths of Tupac and Biggie Smalls. So you're like, it became the fog of war. I'm talking about all these corporations involved in this music. At one point, I'm sure we're going, what the hell is going on? You know a little bit, but it wasn't a complete reality until people finally started. Two of our brightest stars were murdered, you know, and over this war, East Coast, West Coast, music war. You know, it wasn't a gang war.
I just found myself thinking so much as I was watching it about Menace to Society, mm-hmm. about how a young man of color can buy into the image of young men of color in the media and how transformative that can be in such dangerous ways.
It's so powerful because, you know, we know how powerful movies are. We know how we felt when we came out of a Bruce Lee film, Enter the Dragon. We know how we felt when we came out of Scarface. Let's say go see Goodfellas. And if you would go to the bathroom, you know, especially younger, during the movie, you had this swagger, you know, especially when you saw Bruce Lee films back in the day. You know, this is a swagger you had that you carried out when you were watching these films. And what happened with gangster rap was music's I think, even more powerful than cinema, although I think cinema is the greatest creative medium there is because you can put them all into cinema, you know. But I think music is the most powerful medium because it goes right to your soul instantaneously like that, you know. And when you got, like, someone as off the charts charismatic and, like, you're just an absolute rock star like Tupac, and go back to Eazy-E and N.W.A. and Ice Cube and how powerful that was. These kids, and me included, we got caught up in that. You know, we wanted to gangbang. We wanted to sell drugs. Even if we were, at the time, I was middle class. I remember upper class white kids that were selling crack cocaine because Eazy-E made it hot. You know, so it was, I'm talking about a white kid. Now imagine what that does to a community of, you know, impoverished black youth, you know.
But you can deal with it in sort of textual terms. And the film opens with Jimmy quoting Goodfellas. You know, go into a scene from Goodfellas, and then there's score from The Untouchables. Mm-hmm. And you actually, in some ways, treat it like it's a gangster film. You almost treat it as if it's The Godfather Part 1 and Part 2.
Yeah, and I was conscious of that. I wanted to treat it like a gangster film because it ultimately was a gangster film. You know, and it wasn't fiction. It was real, you know. And also, you know, it was part of me as a filmmaker. And I'm like, man, I don't want, this is a documentary. I don't want anyone getting bored. So let's make sure that there's an urgency here and that they know right from the jump that this is not going to be your grandfather's documentary, you know, because it's not about your grandfather. You know, even Jimmy Iovine, 64 years old, he's more millennial than these millennials. So he's, you know, he may be 64, but and Dre's 52. These guys are, there's a attention deficit disorder there with both of them that's off the charts. They're off the charts brilliant, but they, you know, what happened and what they came out of and what we all came out of, you know, I used to have a deal at Interscope. I had a record label there for 4 years as well. I'm a massive fan of music, you know, period. So it was my turn to DJ, essentially. And that was the most exciting thing about this film. You know, I was watching, there's a debate amongst my friends, you and I haven't talked about it yet, about Dunkirk and whether it, you know, there should have been character development or whether it's a great story because he was so efficient and this, that, and the other. I just saw it a few days ago, and I'm like, at the end of the day, it's like impeccable filmmaking, and he's manipulating you the whole time with sound. That's what's happening. You know, I don't care what the debate is about the narrative and character development. You're being, and that's what was happening with the Defiant Ones. It was the first time I got the opportunity with me, because documentaries, you can change the subject, drop it like a hot potato out of nowhere. You can't do that in features. And so I was excited by the possibility of, like, wow, I'm a wannabe DJ. So I get to DJ this, you know. I get to do it with a world-class composer like Atticus Ross and Claudia and Leo, composers, you know, and that's what I found so fascinating about Social Network. Even though Atticus and I had been working years before he did that, and he had done Book of Eli before that. So we're not just talking about, in The Defiant Ones, whether I took something from Blade Runner or whether I took something from Untouchables or, I don't know, from JFK. Then there's the source music, the hip-hop music. Then there's the samples, like the hip-hop records that were so famous. I would go find the samples and drop those so people would go, oh, wow, that's what that came from.
Yeah, because there's a cover of a song from the Shaft soundtrack.
Was it Bumpy's Lament?
Yeah.
Yeah, when Jimmy's seducing his first wife. And that was my way of going, see, this is a Dr. Dre track. And we did that with American Pimp as well. So with the score, when you look back at what Atticus and Trent did with Social Network, that film was a deposition. It's a talking heads film is what I'm saying. And essentially documentaries are talking head. It's a talking head medium. So how do we push that medium too? That was a painful part of the process, is like, I don't want to just do this and, you know, and do what's been done before. Let's push it. What can I bring? And I know cinema. That's all I know, you know.
It's a treatment. We're talking about cinema with my guest, Alan Hughes. He's the director of the 4-part documentary series on HBO, The Defiant Ones, which is on every platform HBO has. But as we're talking about this, I go back to something you guys, something you said to me when we first met. We started to talk about Dead Presidents, and you said you guys are out to make Apocalypse Now. So you've always wanted to work in an epic canvas, mm-hmm. and this is an epic canvas, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
You're correct. I remember back then a lot of those reviews on dead presidents were ambitious, too ambitious. And I learned that that was a negative thing. People didn't, I guess some of the critics at the time didn't feel we landed it. And we were young. I don't believe we did land that film. You know, it's three different films, and I don't think the script was that great. We just didn't get the time. We were being rushed into that. So this is the first time where I feel like, oh, my creative ambitions, they landed. You know, I think the film clocks in like just under 4.5 hours, all four parts, you know, and as disparate as the genres and the cultures are, it represents what I feel, what I'm into, what I like, you know, variety. But to get into all of that stuff, you know, and to all those narratives and all those great stories and all those great artists and all that insane business, you know, like the cunning that was going on in the, as far as the business of it, I didn't know it was going to land, but I just knew that this was my opportunity to keep swinging. And I just remember, because we didn't have a script. You don't have a script when you're doing a documentary. And, you know, I remember when we cut our first scene, which happens to be the prologue of the movie with the Apple deal going sour with the Tyrese Facebook deal.
That was the first thing you showed me. You were just putting all that stuff together when the last time I'd seen you before the film came out.
That was the first scene we cut. And I got goosebumps. And I said, oh, shit, we're in trouble, because everything's got to be up to this or beyond this. It can't be less than this, you know, because it was so unique and so dynamic. I had a vision for it, but I got to give Doug Prey, my partner, co-writer and editor, credit. You know, I told him what I wanted, but he went off on a lazy Sunday and came back with that. What's in the film? We made a trim like 10 seconds out of it, you know, and I was like, and so that was exciting. I'm like, I haven't felt this before in a documentary. Let's go after this. Let's chase this dragon.
Has that always been the way you worked as a filmmaker, that you basically feel like you first and foremost want to communicate to the audience?
I think so. Yeah. I recently with this project is the first time where I realized how passionate I am about that. And I started listening. And on this film, I was listening to a lot of interviews with, for some reason, Orson Welles. But I had to balance it with Hitchcock. I wasn't watching their films, because I've been watched so many of them, and I don't even remember them. My cinephile brain is just fried right now. But I remember Hitchcock saying, this is the cinema. You make these films for 2,000 seats, not one seat. You know, I got to grab their attention with how I know how to grab people's attention, which is with the sonics, you know, and the way it's shot, the way it feels, you know. And I always, this is my rule to myself. I go, if someone's standing in the kitchen cooking and this just happens to come on TV, will it make them walk out of the kitchen? And that's what I ask myself every 2-3 minutes. I go, does this sound or feel like if someone was in the kitchen and they were overhearing this, that they'd walk out and check this out? And that's kind of the science I use. It's a little bit cavemanish in Detroit, but that's what it is.
Well, he says that he's looking at a caveman from Detroit. It's the treatment. My guest is Alan Hughes. He's the director of The Defiant Ones on HBO. We'll take a break. If there's more to come, stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm sitting here talking with Alan Hughes. His terrific 4-part documentary on Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, The Defiant Ones, is on HBO. One of the things, though, that we talked about a bit, and I want to get into it a little bit here, chop this up, is, and you've been talking about Biggie and Tupac, but there was so much, I mean, it's the first time that pop culture has really felt dangerous in a really physical way. I mean, sometimes it's been about people being afraid of the media, being afraid of being rock and roll or whatever. There's this fear it's going to change things, and it really didn't lead to the kind of casualties and the kind of open fear and the assault on all sides. I mean, usually there's one side against another, but everybody's embattled in this thing. And I just wonder, as it took you back to that period, if you just sort of felt some sense of regret that pop culture felt like it was bigger than anybody. And it couldn't be contained by anything. Mm-hmm. And I just remember feeling this sense of dread in it about the third episode. Oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, in the third episode, I won't spoil it or part. I try not to say episode now.
Third installment.
The third part, by the end of it, it gives me goosebumps in a mixed feelings kind of way, because Tupac is, you literally hear him lullabying himself to death, his death, you know? I mean, that's the track that's on, is him talking about death, and it's melodic, and it's for about a minute, and he's lullabying himself right into his death. But you also see the death march. You see his actions. You see that, you know, and I can identify with this in different ways, but he was a massive fan of, like, myth-making. He completely understood that. He studied Eazy-E. Eazy-E was the grandmaster of it. But Eazy-E knew where the line was.
In fact, all those guys, and basically with the exception of Eazy, those guys are all middle-class kids mm-hmm. who took on these guises and got sucked into that whole vortex of danger themselves.
Straight up, yeah. I mean, exception of Eazy and Snoop. The rest of them, you know, I'm talking about most of the big-time guys, weren't really doing all that stuff. Let's just be real. It's a movie, you know. And including Tupac, you know. Tupac comes from rough areas, has seen rough stuff, but he wasn't a street kid like that, you know. He's a good dude, you know. He's a well-read dude, and it is mythical now. What a great performer, how great he was. And so he just didn't understand where the myth-making stopped. In reality, he lost sight of that. And so you can see in part three, about the last 20 minutes of the film, you see him literally running into the fire.
Well, as we talk about that, we can't, and Defiant Ones confronts head on the whole situation with the unfortunate woman journalist who got mm-hmm. caught up in all this, mm-hmm. who thought she knew these guys and turned out she didn't.
Yeah, Dee Barnes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a great point for you to bring it up in that context, because Dre was caught up at the time. You know, Dre was literally intoxicated, but he was also intoxicated with
power.
There was a lot going on at the time. The loss, too. There was loss in his life, and then there was Eazy and India. Everyone's gassing everyone up, and there is a lot of power. And, you know, like Cube had taken some shots at them, and Dee Barnes got caught in the middle of it, and then all of a sudden Dre imploded, you know, and there's no excuse for it, you know, but he got caught up. That was the one time he got caught up where it was just terrible, went terribly wrong for him, you know, and he's had to live with that for all these years, you know, but that was that culture. That's the culture.
But there's the other side of the culture too, with the stuff with Jimmy and his career before hip hop, which is so interesting too, because It goes from Bruce Springsteen to Stevie Nicks to Tom Petty to basically all these people who really couldn't have been less affected by black culture
mm-hmm.
and lived on the outside of that world. It's the movie starts off at that point where there was a schism that at that point black culture and white culture were almost completely disconnected from each other.
Yes.
And then when they intersect, what happens then?
Yes. It became, with those two in particular, it became nuclear. You know, at first in the most positive, like explosive, like this music and the images, I'm talking about both on the rock side and on the hip-hop side, where, you know, whether you're looking at Closer by Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor, all the way over to, you know, California Love, you know, I mean, this is the stuff at its best.
That's the thing I was saying to you. Think about the sort of 14-month period that went from The Chronic mm-hmm. to The Downward Spiral to mm-hmm. Marilyn Manson. That's all within basically a year and a half. That's incredible, and that's basically where these guys' lives are intersecting.
It's at the same place, same companies, you know. And, yeah, you know, you take this guy, Jimmy Iovine, who people didn't know at the time was just a world-class marketing genius. And, you know, he doesn't like being referred to as P.T. Barnum, but he hates that, in fact. But he, you know, on steroids. And then you take this sonic wonder of our time in Dr. Dre. And Trent Reznor is another sonic genius, you know. I mean, this guy's off the charts.
And also another showman in the same way those guys were. These 100%. Guys who yeah. built these... Going back to what you're saying about Tupac, these guys who built these myths around them, and people bought into them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because the thing that's so great about the series for me is it reminds us of the power of those images, and yeah. with music, video, when money was being spent, when ideas are being thrown around left and right. There's so many ideas, in fact, in these things, and how you watch a video and want to see it again because it would just get into your head and change where you heard those songs.
Yeah. Now you know it's funny you're touching on something that I'm obsessed with, which is iconography as well. Those images that leave those indelible marks in your head, you know. Michael Jackson was obviously great at that, you know. When you look at Trent Reznor, though, in that Nine Inch Nails Closer video, and that moment he's floating in the air like that, you're like, I remember telling Trent, I said, that was your moonwalk moment, because I didn't listen to Nine Inch Nails before I saw that video. In fact, that video made me understand the music. Just like when I saw, when you see Billie Jean, if someone played Billie Jean back then just cold for you, Michael Jackson off a Thriller, I'm not going to say you wouldn't have thought it was hot, but he showed you how to understand it, because we hadn't heard a beat like that before or that rhythm. You know, we had heard versions of it, but like the way he synthesized it like that. So Trent had that vision. Dre had that vision. When you see the G Thing video, as hood as it is, there were these, you know, iconic moments in them that just left that mark, especially when you got to the party and you saw the way people were moving to the music. That's the most important thing, is that they show you how this music, the how do you say it, the movement of it, you know, and that's the genius of it, is when an artist can understand, like, I gotta show the world how to move to my music, how to understand my music. And they use iconography.
Both and audio and visual. Yeah. Visual and oral iconography are used. Because the thing that is that the films remind me of is just, you forget until you listen to stuff back to back how danceable hip hop was.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
It's Dre pulling all those beats that were classic old school R&B dance tracks and recycling those and sampling those and turning those into big pieces of storytelling.
Let's just dissect Dre for a second. Sure. The science that's not obvious to people is like, he first started his career off as a world-class DJ, as a DJ. And a DJ's job is to make everyone move to the dance floor. And even the guy that's a curmudgeon-y and doesn't want to dance, it's his job to make his...
Even the guy staying at the bar who doesn't want to go dance.
Yeah, got to make his foot tap, you know. Then he moves in very soon after that into, we all know now, the world-class Wrecking Crew, which is more dance, romance, electro... kind of hip-hop music, but it was a dance romance group. So it was a seductive nature to that group, you know? And we didn't know at the time, like, what a sonic wonder he was, you know? And we now know. And in his, when you heard F*** the Police for the first time, you're like, it was like going to the Cinerama Dome. You know, that's how his records, that was what made Dre different. But his secret ingredient, if you listen to G-Thing, is women can go to the dance floor and groove. They don't have to jump to their legs like Kid and Play and all that hippity-hoppity-hop hip-hop stuff where the drink is spilling out of the, you know. It was a seductive groove, and they're talking gangster shit. And so that alchemy was what made it special. It's dangerous, but it's seductive, and I think that's Dre's science. I don't think he knows that. I don't think he's aware of it, you know.
It's interesting because I think the thing that unites them, besides the fact that in their way they're both filmmakers, mm-hmm. both Jimmy and Dre are both storytellers, they're also both really attracted to epic stories. I mean, you think about the artists that Jimmy worked with, he turned them into icons. And yes. They're just on the verge of becoming that, the way the transformative power we had with Tom Petty. I mean, and I still can't not think about that Damn and the Repeaters album cover, yeah. which is the way people still think about Tom Petty 30 years later, 40 years later, as a matter of fact. That's the thing that unites them both, isn't it? They are both attracted to epic stories, aren't they?
That's, you know, a great observation. I hadn't thought about that, but 100% when I think about Jimmy and Dre, and I'm getting ready to go see Jimmy. I haven't seen him since the films come out. You know, he's always looking at that big picture, that big bang, that big symbol, you know, and so is Dre. Like, what is that? You know, you look at the Eminem story. They weren't looking for a controversial white rapper. They were looking for great. And when Jimmy brought that tape to him, talk about epic, you know. And that's at a time where Dre was down and out.
No, that's, as I said to you so many times, that period after Aftermath.
Yes.
Where he thought he was done, and he was dismissed by everybody.
We all thought he was done. You know, I mean, it was. I mean, we all were a little shook behind that. And at the time, too, you're not trying.
As was he.
Oh, my God, was he. We now know because he's comfortable enough to talk about it. But the last thing you're looking for at that point in 1997 was a white rapper. You're not looking for a white rapper.
Also, the last thing you're looking for is seeing Dre doing ballroom dancing.
Well, before the white rapper, yeah, you're not looking for Dre doing the tango, obviously. But if you now look at that track that he got so much flack for at the time called Been There, Done That, Every word of it was prophetic.
And it's also as great a track as anything else he's done.
It's an amazing track. I mean, I love that we got to cut the opening of the part four to that track because it's an incredible track.
And it's the track because so many people dismissed Aftermath. Almost nobody knows it.
Yes. Yeah. And I've heard people on social media go, "Hey, I didn't know The Firm was a bomb. I thought that record was hot." And technically, it sold well. It just didn't sell as much as his previous records. It wasn't The Chronic, yeah.
But it's funny, because in watching this a couple of times, which I don't normally do, and to look at the whole picture of the culture in each decade, what these guys' instinct almost always turned out to be is understanding there's a story that wasn't being told.
Yes.
And responding to that story emotionally, first and foremost, and not thinking about what kind of repercussion it would have, because they all end up having much bigger repercussions than either of these guys could have imagined in almost every single case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can relate to it because I've always felt that way. Even making this thing, I was like, okay, I don't think this story's been told like this. And I don't think we've ever felt anything. Let me keep pushing that.
Was that partially because hip-hop still doesn't get its due, that it's still not recognized as, in the way that all these iconic artists that Jimmy worked with, who are always taken seriously, who, much to Snoop's dismay, always made the cover of Rolling Stone magazine when that period when hip-hop was not. But hip-hop never got its due in terms of its impact on the culture.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because as we talk, I realized that was probably the chip I had on my shoulder.
Yeah.
And I had the advantage of going, all right, we're going to go from a Stevie Nicks scene to an Eazy-E scene, you know, from a Marilyn Manson to Tupac. So I got to bring, let's just say, white audiences to places that they wouldn't normally have to be, and vice versa, by the way, you know. So I had to make sure that anyone that loved rock was going to hang around for this next 10 minutes of hip-hop. And so the fidelity, let's just talk about the fidelity in all senses of the word, you know, sonically, visually, rhythmically, I had to be 100% at all times. And that's what's been remarkable now. It's been out for nearly a month, is to see all these people that never liked hip hop. They're buying these records now, talking about them, getting goosebumps about it. You know, it's a new thing for them. And by the way, there's a lot of hip-hop heads that are digging rock that they never even thought they would be digging, you know. But again, the rule for me, and I don't know if it was a rule, just the methodology, was I just had in my head, I don't know what anyone else's 100% is like, the fidelity at all times has got to be 100% clear. And you got to, if you're in a kitchen and this thing is on TV, I got to get you out of that kitchen, and that's the bottom line.
My guest who's tried to exhort you to get out of the kitchen is Alan Hughes. We're out of time. His great documentary series of four installments, not parts.
Parts, not episodes.
Forgive my imprecision. For parts is The Defiant Ones on HBO. Alan, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis. Finally.
Finally. Now you get to see what it's like to have dinner with this man. Our recording engineer here at NPR, Wes, is Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Ure. It's edited by Blake White, who's associate producer. I don't have any epics in me. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.